U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Republicans lose again in off-year elections on Tuesday in Virginia. And this time it appears they may have lost the Kentucky governorship, too. What do these results tell us about American political trends and perhaps what they tell us about the election in 2020, or at least where we stand now, a year out from 2020? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with my peerless peers, Kim Strassel. How are you, Kim?
I'm good. How are you, Paul?
Fine, thank you. And Kyle Peterson too. Hi, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
So let's talk about the election results. Granted, these are off year results, only a few relatively small election sample, but Democrats, I think, have the greater bragging rights this time. And frankly, it makes 3 years in a row. I mean, in 2018, they turned the House majority around. 2017, they cleaned up in state elections in Virginia. They won that governorship. And now they've turned the legislature in Virginia, which is a very important state. Used to be solid Republican at the presidential level. Now Republicans haven't won it in some time. They did control the state legislature, but now they lost that. They both lost the House of Delegates and the Senate. And that means we have a solidly Democratic state going into 2020, which means that because the next governor's race won't be until 2021. Of course, you have, Kim, the census in 2020. And after that, Democrats, I think the biggest implication of this is that Democrats are going to be able to redraw the maps for the legislature and for U.S. House districts to cement their majorities for a decade.
Yeah, this is the first time in a quarter century that Democrats have had total control of the legislature there in Virginia. And they did it in particular by not just getting their base out to vote, but convincing a lot of suburban voters, and not just outside of D.C., but even down in the southern part of the state this time around Richmond, to come out and vote for them. And I think you put your finger on their big goal of this project. You saw a lot of outside Democratic money flow into the state to get this result. And it is very much aimed not just at some of the things Democrats have been promising, which are stricter gun laws, more Medicare spending, Medicaid spending, excuse me, et cetera, but also because Democrats have made a priority of state houses in these upcoming elections because of the 2020 census, and they want to redraw these maps to make sure that they maintain control in the House, the federal House, and maintain control of these state chambers for a decade to come.
It looks to me like, in addition to the money that poured in from outside, including, I think, $2.5 million from Mike Bloomberg's, former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg's gun control operation, you had big money from Emily's List. You had the League of Conservation of Voters playing, but also you had general unpopularity by Trump, Donald Trump, in the state. I think his approval rating is really low. It's in the neighborhood of 30% in Virginia, at least according to one Roanoke poll. And and that has tended to drive up Democratic turnout, and the Republicans just haven't adjusted, as Fred Barnes wrote on our pages recently.
Yeah, and although it's true that Democrats have also been, or excuse me, Republicans have also been struggling in Virginia for a long time. I mean, a Republican candidate hasn't won a statewide race there since 2009. Some of that is just to the changing demographics. I mean, the growth of the urban areas, particularly in Northern Virginia, but some of it seems to be due to changing, you know, what those suburban voters want politically as well. as well, excuse me. I mean, the last member of the last Republican in the state house that was representing Northern Virginia lost last night. So Northern Virginia is solid blue. I mean, that is a change not on demographics, since that's a 2-year swing. That's based on who those people wanted to support. But I also think it's, beyond what Virginia might do in it with its own policies, I also think it's bad for policy competition. I think it was a good thing that surrounding the Capitol, surrounding this urban area, you had one state on one side that was blue, one state on one side that was red. Giving people who were moving there or living there a choice of where they wanted to go. I mean, around New York, that has all but disappeared. I mean, it's a solid, there used to be some of that in Connecticut, and now it's a solid blue block. And that may be what we're going to get now in Virginia and Maryland.
I think you are going to get that in Virginia and Maryland. Kim, what do you think gun control, what role gun control played here? Because guns and ownership of guns and gun regulation used to play for the Republican advantage in Virginia. Now it seems to me it's turned to the Democratic advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a function of the dynamic that Kyle was just describing, that there has been a big shift in demographics. And that's not in any way to excuse entirely Republican failures here. But, you know, Republicans were managing to hold on for a number of years to some of these districts, especially in Northern Virginia and on the outer edges of some of these exurbs like Loudoun, et cetera, Loudoun County, with candidates that, you know, were in no way Trumpian, but were certainly Republican, and they were able to do so on issues like, we're going to protect you from greater gun restrictions. We are the party that cares more about fiscal prudence, et cetera. That's just not playing anymore in those areas where you have these suburban voters, in particular women, who have shifted their views on this or who have moved into the area and brought their politics with them. And the Republicans, I think their big failure yesterday is not so much some of those areas, which I think are just increasingly hard for them to keep, but they just haven't, in the areas that are competitive, just have not struck upon the kind of right candidates to resonate with this new electorate.
Let's talk about Kentucky, the governorship. Matt Bevin, the incumbent, won in 2015 pretty comfortably, but appears to have lost, although that as we talk now, I don't believe he has conceded yet to Andrew Beshear, the Democratic Attorney General, who is the son of a former governor. It's a narrow race within a couple of percentage points, a few thousand votes, but it appears that Beshear will win. And if indeed he does win, the result will be due to Bevin just getting swamped in the suburbs. I mean, around Lexington, he lost by something like 99,000 votes. I mean, rather Louisville area around Lexington lost by 36,000 votes. By comparison, in 2015, he lost Lexington by only 10,000 votes and Louisville by 38,000. So that's by far and away the biggest difference. And turnout statewide this time up about 50% from 2015. So Democrats, again, showing they're really, really motivated. Part of the problem is Bevin was deeply unpopular. And himself. Other Republicans did well enough in this election, so some of it is personal with Bevin. But those suburban trends now, we have three elections in a row, 2017, 2018, and now 2019, where Republicans are just getting clocked in the suburbs.
There's two statistics that are a little bit cross-cutting here that I think are interesting. One is the one that you're laying out, and you know, President Trump won Kentucky by almost 30 points in 2016. So obviously, a loss like this is not great for his prospects, for Republicans' prospects going into the future. One other idea, though, is that you're hearing this in a lot of conservative circles, that this was a Bevin-related problem, and that may be true. I mean, he was aggressive and kind of grating in a way that Trump can get away with because he's funny and because he's a media figure in a way that regular old politicians are not. And what you're hearing is that the Republican candidate for attorney general. Apparently, the Republican hasn't held that post in 70 years. I mean, he also won last night and by a very significant margin. And so, you know, if you're a Republican looking for the silver lining, maybe the problem here was the candidate, not necessarily the election.
All right. We're talking about the election results from 2019 Tuesday, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson. Kim, on that point, though, from Kyle regarding Matt Bevin's personal liabilities as a candidate, I do think in some respects this was a referendum on what I would call the Trumpian style of politics. Bevin is was not Donald Trump, clearly. He doesn't have a lot of his assets, but he does shoot from the lip. He was alienating. He did run on a lot of divisive cultural issues. And he was deeply disliked by many Republicans. I think his approval rating in the state among Republicans was in the 50% category. So, yes, these conservatives who are saying, okay, this is not necessarily a hint of what is going to happen in 2020 is right. Trump himself will be on the ballot. He's not going to lose Kentucky. But nonetheless, I still think this suburban phenomenon is the real issue that Republicans have to address.
Yeah, it's hard to know. In many ways, as you said, there is a Trumpian style politics associated with Bevin, in particular on issues like immigration. In the final weeks of this race, he, you know, warned that Andy Beshear, his opponent, would let illegal immigrants swarm the state. It was a big talking point on his part. And so in that regard, to the extent that Trump often makes similar points, you have to wonder how he then fares in these suburban districts next year when he's on the ballot. I think the other side of this, and to what Kyle was saying, is that Bevin was also, in his own way, uniquely off-putting to many people in the state, too, over local issues. So, for instance, one of the things that really took a knock on his popularity was the attacks he put on teachers in the middle of this teacher sick-out and walk-out that was there, suggesting that teachers have put children's safety at risk and harmed them when there was really no evidence for that. He at some point walked back that claim, but then doubled down on it again at the end of the election. He had demanded an investigation into his predecessor in office, and also just some kooky things, like he said, you know, that he deliberately made all of his children subject to the chicken pox because he didn't want to vaccinate them. There were just a lot of odd aspects to his governance. But I mean, I think your broad point is the important one, is that the trend overall in suburban districts is not necessarily great for a Donald Trump on the ballot in 2020.
Generally speaking, for Republicans who will be running in for the Senate, for example, in Arizona and North Carolina and Colorado, and some of those, a couple of those, need to win if the Republicans are going to hold the Senate in 2020. One good news, bit of good news for the Republicans this year was that they did win the Mississippi governorship, with Tate Reeves winning comfortably by 5.6% at last count over the Attorney General of the state, Jim Hood, who is a trial lawyer specialist and devotee. But even that race was a lot closer than 4 years earlier, when the Republicans won by more than 30%, although that was, I think, an incumbent president running at the time, incumbent governor. So, but still closer than I think most Republicans would like. And I think it was Donald Trump, when he went down there, said, "I can't believe this race is competitive. Come on, it's Mississippi."
Right. And again, similar to Kentucky, the concern for Republicans is not necessarily that they're going to lose Mississippi or Kentucky in the 2020 presidential race. It's what happens down ballot. The Senate you spoke about, there's a lot of these competitive Senate races in Colorado where the suburban areas could be decisive in whether Republicans can hold those seats. And the same goes for the House. There are areas, I'm not directly familiar with the intimate details of the Kentucky House map specifically, but for sure there have to be areas where there are House seats that if there is a swing of 10 or 15 points away from Republicans in those suburban areas, where those seats would be very hard to retake or would be put at risk of Republican losses.
One of those seats is around Lexington. So if that trend continues, you could begin to see you could make it that much more difficult, Kim, to take back the House of Representatives, notwithstanding some Republican hopes that we're hearing that because the Democrats are going to impeach Donald Trump, some of those swing Democratic members who will vote to impeach could be in jeopardy in 2020. But if the suburban trend kind of moves the other way towards the Democrats, that becomes that much harder to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing here is that with these rallies that Trump is partaking in, and this has been obvious for some time now, that the White House appears to be pursuing a strategy of base turnout, revving up its people. And look, we should be clear that in places like Kentucky, some of that upswing in turnout that you were talking about went to the Republican. And, Matt Bevin did very well in rural counties, extremely well. So that is what they're pursuing. But I think what we're also seeing is that strategy is not necessarily going to prove to be enough or successful in these marginal areas. Not marginal, but rather swing areas. And this has been the choice that the Trump presidency has faced for a long time now. And I think a lot of Republicans have been encouraging the White House to adopt a strategy that does more outreach to those communities and suburban voters. But so far, there just is no indication that that is the Trump campaign strategy.
Any other races at the more local and state level that grabbed your attention, Kyle, the results?
Well, one that we've written about is the Denver School Board. So for a long time, for years, the Denver School Board has had a pro-reform majority where they've instituted such things as teacher merit pay. And in the last election, a few of those seats were lost, and some of the local races are still being counted. But the Denver Post headline is saying that it looks like that school board has flipped, and now the pro-reform majority has been lost to a group of candidates who are especially backed by the teachers' unions. And so charter schools, merit pay, all those kind of reforms that conservatives have liked and have said have improved the schooling and have been even backed on a bipartisan basis by people like Michael Bennett.
Well, when he was school superintendent, he pushed for them.
Right. That may be coming to an end, and you may end up in a situation where there's less reform and caps on things, like we've seen in Boston, where there's just waiting lists for charter schools because they can't get the cap raised.
Well, it's going to be they're a wholly owned subsidiary of the teachers' unions. It's going to be it's the end to reform, education reform in the Denver schools if this turns out that way. Still waiting on results, I guess, in the Seattle City Council, where Amazon had backed some merely liberal candidates as opposed to the socialists who tried to impose a $250 tax on each employee on companies. But still waiting on statewide referendum on affirmative action and racial preferences because the results in Washington State often come in late. Let me just, before we go, broaden this a bit to 2020, Kim. I think it's too much to say that this election or the last three are a forecast of what will happen in 2020. But I will say this. What I take from these last three Novembers is that Democrats are really, really, really highly motivated, and they are going to come out. And Republicans have to have a difficult act here. In response, they have to mobilize their own base for sure, the Trump base. But the Trump base isn't enough to win. They also have to win enough voters in these suburban districts, particularly right-leaning women, who right now the approval rating for white college-educated women for Trump in the WSJ NBC poll, 34%. It's basically one in three. If Republicans can't win white suburban college-educated women, they're not going to win the election no matter how much you drive your base out.
Well, I do agree with that, though I guess the devil's advocate in me would also point out that we have a long way to go, obviously, till that day. And we have a lot of ground to cover in terms of where Democrats come out with their own nominee. And, you know, there was some interesting cross-cutting information that also came out this week, which sent a little shiver of fear down Democrats, too. The New York Times came out with a number of polls in swing states with matchups between Donald Trump and the different leading Democratic nominees. And, you know, we talk a lot often about these national polls, but obviously it's the battleground states that matter. And, you know, it was notable when you looked at Trump versus Warren in these six states. It was Arizona, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Trump was tied or ahead in five of those six states against Warren. If you looked at him versus Sanders, they each won about an equal number of states. And if you looked at him in terms of Biden, he was losing in most states, although all of these numbers were easily within the margin of error of the poll. So, you know, it's just not clear. And some of this is going to depend on who the Democrats put out there. You know, I think an Elizabeth Warren is a much tougher sell to Americans than a Joe Biden. And but I think an important part, too, is also going to be whether or not the president makes some effort to get some of these voters that you're talking about. We haven't seen that so far.
I do think that New York Times Siena poll was something of an outlier. I mean, some of the other swing state polls show that Trump is losing to most Democratic candidates pretty comfortably. I do agree, though, that Elizabeth Warren would be a better candidate from Trump's point of view to run against, because her economic and healthcare and other agenda would be something that might scare a lot of those suburban voters and say, you know, as much as I don't like Trump's style or his rhetoric or his divisive governance style, he is somebody who, you know, scares me less than Elizabeth Warren taking away my health insurance and giving it to the gentle folks at the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously, past returns don't guarantee future results. But one of the things that makes this more interesting, perhaps as a harbinger, than other off-year elections in other presidential pre-presidential years, is just that Trump is such a singular figure. I mean, a normal politician would read these results and would think to himself, I may be in trouble here among suburban women, say. How can I adjust my pitch to deal with that? Maybe I should tone down some of the rhetoric. Maybe I should, you know, tweet a third less often. But there seems to be no evidence that maybe people in the White House think that way, but there's no evidence, at least that I can see, that Trump himself thinks that way. And it has any intention of moderating himself in the way that a normal politician, a Bill Clinton, somebody like that would.
Well, that's QED, what has been demonstrated. But I will say this, the trend in the Obama years, 8 years, what we saw was Obama's divisive style of governments created a political reaction that resulted in Republicans first taking the House, taking an enormous number of governorships, the majority of governorships, a historic number of governorships in the states, almost 1,000, gaining almost 1,000 state legislative seats, and then finally taking the Senate in 2014 and then that White House in 2016. We're seeing so far in three elections that reversal coming in. Democrats took the House in 2018. They have picked up governorships. They have picked up legislative chambers and seats. What's going to happen? I mean, is the Senate in danger and is the White House in danger now with this counter reaction sweep? Kim, last word.
Well, again, I always advocate humility in these things because we all did a pretty poor job of the last presidential election. But I do agree that the trends here are certainly ones that should be concerning to the White House. How it all plays out in the end is something that I think that we still don't understand that entire dynamic.
All right. We shall be following this in what is going to be a fascinating and no doubt calm, cool and collected year for American politics. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back Friday with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.